And
what about the fan? Is the fan off?
It's on low. Let it be. Let it be. I'll warm up when I teach. I'll make it colder. First of all, the date. Today is April 28th, 2014. It's Monday morning, and tomorrow I'll be on the plane for YU in New York. So today we're still teaching YU in Jerusalem. And I don't know what I got myself into. I thought they're giving me COVID in New York. I can tell you I'm an avid Nitzav. You would see the schedule they have for me. I think I'm going to be enslaved. But okay, we'll take it with a grain of salt. I just want to mention, following the earlier lectures, I heard from my Talmud Andrew Rosenberg. I believe he's from Lakewood. So what we spoke about with Torah Vadas, wanting to open a college. So my Talmud Andrew quotes a speech by Rabbi Yitzvei, who I knew quite well from Lakewood and from my rabbinate in Lower Mary. He was right near me in Philadelphia. I used to give him lifts in my car, and my jalopy was the first car I owned. So it's a talk he gave at the Aguda convention in 99. And in the talk, he rails against college and YU in particular, claiming that in his time in the 1940s, Bacharim were leaving Torah Vadas to Reitz, only to end up as conservative rabbis. To stem the flow, Rav Shraga Feibel Mendelovich decided to open a college within the yeshiva. When he asked the Baron Kotler, however, the Rosh Yeshiva responded, "B'nei Torah will not come out of such a yeshiva." And because of his reaction, Rav Shraga Feibel mixed the plan. I have to tell you, this is true or not true. In other words, I will stick with the version that appeared in tradition, the version that appears in Helmreich's book. It wasn't the college within Torah Vadas. It was a college in Brooklyn that would service Chaim Berlin, Torah Vadas, Mir, everyone's going to college, so let it be a college under Torah auspices. As far as the Bachrim ending up conservative rabbis, I have bad news for you, and Rebbe Yitzvei should have a lichtig Gan Eden. All I can tell you is Torah Vadas boys and Chaim Berlin boys ended up very good conservative and reform rabbis as well. And when Rabbi Rubin and I rabbinated in the Philadelphia area, we can both say Eitet Nemanah, that one of the well-known conservative rabbis in Philly was a Torah Vadas graduate. But I will say to his credit, you're a Torah Vadas, so I don't want to mention his name, but he has grandchildren who are Shomrei Torah Mitzvot living in Israel. So Baruch Hashem.
If I may.
Yeah, what?
I was a chaplain in Texas.
Right.
So I came as a whole Grandian captain, and I asked for a house of the post. They told me you have to be a lieutenant colonel or above to have a house of the post. But I told them it was Shabbos. It was 5 miles to walk
to right.
Where I had to live. They said, oh, that's something all you rabbis do. I found out that the previous rabbi, who was a Torah Vadas graduate, he got a house on the post because of Shabbos. He would drive in his car to Dallas after davening, charge the boys $2 each because they had a dance Saturday night at the music center. So he would drive, they would cover his gas.
Right. So what you're saying is it wasn't only Reitz boys, it was a time when lower Lano from all the yeshiva people went off the path. Today it's a different story.
What happened was when the colonel in charge of G1, the personnel, saw that I was actually walking because he wanted me to ride and explain to my dead neighbor.
Right.
I asked for Rabarin, by the way, if I'm allowed to carry my ID card.
Right.
He told me yes.
Which Rabarin, when you say Rabarin?
Rabarin Soloveitchik.
Rabarin Soloveitchik. I would carry it in my shoe or in my hat.
It would destroy it.
Because we had the problem in Russia. I carried everything in my hat. You know, I showed the hat. I don't know if I showed it this year, but if you remind me, I can bring it in and show you the hat with a pocket in it that my wife built. It's a museum piece today. Also, I quoted from one of the Haredi papers how they went to Davin on the Kever, Reb Shmuel Shmulka Klein of Selesh, who was the great great grandfather of Yair Lapid. So either I made a mistake or what I was quoting made a mistake. It's not the Hasidic Reb Shmuel Shmelka. It's the Ungarische Reb Shmuel Shmelka. So I'm very pedantic. I'm happy when people correct me. I'm the happiest person alive. I stand corrected. Finally, in regard to your quotation of Reb Moshe Chaim Alta Pecker's account of his survival arrived in the U.S., his surname is pronounced Pecker. The I is silent. I actually had the pleasure of making the acquaintance of Reb Alta. He was a remarkable man who left generations of B'nai Torah and Mabitzei Torah. So I thank my comrade Abraham Rosenberg for his comments and corrections. And I also want to mention my dear Talmud Rabbi Yonis and the Berger. If you recall, I mentioned in class that getting married in a shul. Remember, we got involved in a whole discussion, and Rabbi Soloveitchik was Masada Kedushin in the shul, and Rabbi Lamb's daughter married my Sarah Zichrona Levracha, which is hard for me to say. She died here. You know, Sarah Lamb. She died so young. And God takes the best. What can I say? If we're alive and kicking here, maybe it's not a good sign for us, but it means we have to strive to be better. So Rabbi Lamb's daughter married my student, Rabbi Mark Tratch, so the Rav was Masada Kedushin in the shul, but Rav David Lifshitz absolutely refused. So I mentioned that in Eretz Yisrael, I saw with my own eyes when they dedicated, I heard with my own ears when they dedicated the great synagogue, they made it tonight they should be able to have weddings there. So my student Rabbi Yonason, it's a Tosfos that I talk and know. It's in Megillah. Here it says page 56. So divide that; it has to be Chavchet Amid Bet, if I'm correct. In the first Tosfos on the Amid, that you can make a Tanai, and in Bavel there's no problem because ultimately every Beit Knesset in Chutz Laaretz is not going to survive. The Kedusha will disappear. It's like the shuls where I was bar mitzvahed, where some of you were bar mitzvahed. If they're still standing today, they're churches, they're not shuls. So, Avol in Eretz Yisrael, no Tanai will help, because here a shul retains its Kedusha forever. So I wanna say, look at the shuls in the old city that were totally destroyed by our friends, the Arabs. The State Department couldn't care less. And take a look the way they're being rebuilt. So you see that Tosfos, when you go into the Churva and the Ramban Synagogue and all the plans that they're rebuilding, what are they rebuilding now? The Ramban Synagogue, Baruch Hashem, we see Tosfos come to life before our eyes. Okay, gentlemen, we have arrived. And we spent many, many weeks, we spent actually more than a year and a half bringing us to this point, the history of Torah in the United States. I'll tell the guests that I got involved here, I never teach anything I know. From the day I came in Aliyah, no, I write about it in my latest book, my seventh book, I explain why, I learned that from the Rav. I never teach anything I know. But and I've never repeated a lecture in the Kollel since the day the Kollel opened. Unfortunately, two bad things happened. 2 years ago, my mother died. I lost my mother. I had a mother for 74 years. Kozman, you have a mother, you're a kid. Every morning, I'd visit my mother who lived up the block from here, and she would say, Arnie, how are you? Who the hell calls me Arnie today? If I use the word hell, they smack my face. I have to tell them the Rav used the word in class when we learned Sanhedrin. I can repeat exactly how the Rav used the word. He was constructing a machlekes between two people. But my mother, then the other bad thing was Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein took ill, and suddenly I realized my age. So a year and a half ago, I made up my mind on this issue, topic. Unfortunately, I might know more than anyone else alive. I'm going to America now. They're making a Rosh Chodesh festival all over my research in this area. It's time to talk about it and let it be recorded, let it stand. So we spoke about the beginnings in America and everything, and Eitz Chaim and Shir Shvachim Chanan, and what happens with World War II and the right wing and the opposition. And now the Bar Hatzala and Reb Aaron Cutler, we spent a lot of time in Reb Aaron Cutler, who there's no question about it that Torah in America and to a certain degree in Israel was greatly influenced by Reb Aaron. And then even YU, as much as YU would like to think perhaps it was not influenced by Reb Aaron, the very fact that I'm sitting here as a result of Reb Aaron Cutler, he introduced the idea of Kollelim, why no one else had Kollelim, whoever heard of a Kollel, why you had a Kollel in the early 50s, it was a Kollel for, I explain about that, that Kollel was a chesed of Rabbi Belkin for the DPs till they adjusted to America. But whoever heard of a Kollel? But when Lakewood, Kollelim all over America, one after one, why you finally, after my time, when I got smicha, either you knew how to learn or you knew nothing, but they kicked you out into the world. There was no halfway house. So we owe a great debt to Reb Aaron. But now we return to YU. And YU had two tremendous tragedies as I ended off the last class before Pesach. Shocking tragedies. The president and the Rosh Yeshiva and the leading Rebbe died within a few weeks of each other. Now, Rabbi Rebel's death, December 1940, was not unexpected. Rabbi Rebel had, the 30s were very unkind to Rabbi Rebel. The man raises, in theory, $3 million towards building the new campus, and within half a year after the dedication, within 9 months after the dedication, the world caves in, the stock market drops. All of us know what it's like to have, if we experience it ourselves, or you see you have $50,000 in stocks, and within half a year, the $50,000 is worth $10,000, $5,000. And that's the reality. Now, if you can hold on to it for 20 years, you'll gain back your money. If you're familiar with economics, you know what I'm saying. But when you need the money, what good does it do you? You can't hold on to it. And Rabbi Rebel had tremendous problems. The yeshiva almost went off the map, and the 30s were very difficult for him. In addition, Hitler, the requests he was getting, non-visa quota applications, people pleading with the yeshiva for their lives, and you have to deal with the State Department. And Rabbi Rebel suffered heart problems one after another, and finally, in the middle of his shiur, he continued to give shiur through November of 1940. The middle of his shiur, he had a stroke, and a few weeks later, he was dead. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, on the other hand, the great Rebbe who I explained to you how he comes to America, how Rabbi Rebel brought him over, the successor to Reb Shimon Shkop, who had succeeded for 1 year the Meitzer to Ilui, the great Reb Moshe Soloveitchik dies very, very suddenly, January 31st, 1941. And now a tremendous machloket breaks out. Who will be the next president of the yeshiva? And here you have to understand there are a lot of players involved. Number one, who is the legal, who bears the legal responsibility for the yeshiva? The Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees was, of course, a mixed bunch consisting of prominent lay leaders, some of whom were Shomer Shabbos, prominent rabbis, but generally speaking, the Board of Trustees of Yeshiva and Yeshiva College, as it was known at that time in history, 1940-41, you're talking about people who were all within what you would call today modern Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, enlightened Orthodox, Western Orthodox. They fit into that category. The Agudas HaRabbanim, which was the rabbinical organization in America and helped organize the yeshiva and was really in its most powerful stage of life, they were very suspicious because yeshiva now had a college, it had what would become the Bernard Rebel Graduate School, and they felt that they had to control the yeshiva. They had to be certain it remained loyal to tradition, to put it in a popular fashion. In addition, you have not only the Board of Trustees and not only the Agudas HaRabbanim, But you have the most important element of all, and that is the student body. And here we have to understand, this is the greatness of the Litvische Welt compared to the Hasidic world. In the Hasidic world, you belong to a sect. The Rebbe's word is golden. Your opinion counts for very little. The Rebbe rules. Now, it's true, every Rebbe is surrounded by some key Gabbayim, but nevertheless, these Gabbayim only become the Rebbe's Gabbayim because of their total loyalty to the Rebbe. So in the Hasidic world, the average Hasid does not have much say. And I think what I'm saying is absolutely true. It's a fact. It's a fact of definition of Hasidic. Look, if you take Milan Yotegadol from the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, what Chassid is going to tell the Rebbe something? You understand it? But all right, the Rebbe was heads and shoulders above the generation. By the way, one of the greatest Chassidim died, I believe it was on Pesach, I just found out, Rabbi Zalman Posner of Nashville, Tennessee. And I feel very sad that Rabbi Posner and I spoke together at the YOU convention in 1994, I believe it was, right after the Rebbe died. I spoke about the Rebbe who had died a year earlier, and he spoke about the Rebbe, and it was a moment in time. I can't go into what we said now. I write a little bit about it in Washington, but it was a moment in time of Achdut Yisrael, of unity, of love. Love between two Jews. And Reb Zalman Posner was to hear him speak, his command of English. And you know how he became a Hasid? He was just a typical Brooklyn kid growing up in Crown Heights, semi-religious, semi-not religious, like most of us grew up in the Bronx and Brooklyn in that era. And when the Rebbe wasn't even Rebbe yet, in the early 40s, when they were going Tashlich, and the Alter Rebbe, the Friedrich Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, couldn't go. He had a stroke. He was in a wheelchair. But the son-in-law led a whole group of people going Tashlich in what's the park called there on Eastern Prospect Park, on Eastern Parkway, the big beautiful park, the water there, and he was singing a niggin, and some poster heard the Rebbe would become Rebbe. And he said, if he could walk along singing a niggin in America, and Jews were embarrassed. Understand? This is a different America, singing a niggin. What are you, pushing a Yiddishkeit in public? And he joined the crowd singing a niggin. And as they say, the rest is history. So no, a chassid is not going to tell a Rebbe anything. But in the Litvische world, boy, oh boy, did they tell the Rebbeim off. Read the memoir literature. Go back to Volozhin. I'm not talking today, there's no Litvakin left, there's no Litvische Welt. The Hasidim conquered us all, including Rakefet. What do I mean? I'm not a Hasid, but I have such love for Hasidus. I have to often told my students, if you studied with Yeruchim Gerelich, you wouldn't get the liberal attitude you're getting from Aaron Rakefet. But all right, today's world needs Hasidus. It can't survive on the alter Kaltkeit of Litta and the stress on the mind, the individuality. It doesn't play today. Maybe it'll come back in 100 years' time. But did they tell the Rebbeim off? And in YU, the students played a great role. Now, there's a very big problem here, and let me state it in advance. You'll understand it in context, if not this week, next time we meet. Students have one tremendous drawback. They think they know it all. A kid of 22, 23, and by the way, I have to tell you, I'm not talking about you, I'm talking about myself. I left the yeshiva, I was 23 years of age, kicked into the rabbinate. I had a bachelor's summa cum laude, number one in my class. I had 2 master degrees. I already had taken courses towards my doctorate. I thought I knew everything. I was a big shot in the, you know, the Litvische Welt, Gottlob Adam, what it does for you, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. If you recall my lectures on the Muslim movement 10, 20 years ago, you know what I'm talking about. So you think you know it all. Not only that, at that age, you're highly, I'll say it this way, you're black and white. You don't understand that life involves compromise, that you can't think you know it all, that there are other viewpoints out there. You all know what I say. I'd be the first one to put on a shtreimel if they had the answers to all the questions. We don't win with all our students. They don't win with all their students. None of us have total success. So one has to be humble, one has to be meek, one has to be diffident, and you can be the greatest lamdan in the world, but as Mori Rebbe said, and the Rav said time and again, I don't know it all, no one knows. We in the whole sugya in Sanhedrin, to be a member of Sanhedrin, he said, no one knows it all. It means you have to know how to find answers. I never forgot what the Rav said. And believe me, that I'm proud. I am proud to say, I think I know how to find answers. I don't know it all. I don't know it all. Of course not. But the Rebbe used to say, a Talmud Chacham, what does it mean, a Talmud Chacham? It's a contradiction. If you're a Chacham, you're not a Talmud. If you're a Talmud, you're not a Chacham. And the Rebbe said so beautifully, you're a Talmud always striving to become a Chacham. You never become a full Chacham, but you're a Talmud striving to be. It's a beautiful, beautiful word. So, and students, particularly at that age, I went into the rabbinate, I got my ears chopped off, and believe me, it was the greatest gift that happened to me because it totally took away my ego, myself. Say that, I don't have to talk about myself. But those of you who know me know what I'm saying. Baruch Hashem, I got killed in the rabbinate, my first rabbinate, but it turned me into a mensch at a very early age. I became a mensch at the age of 23, 24. And that's an achievement. Now, why is this so important? Because when you have this attitude, you know it all, you know everything, enmity develops, hatred develops, this one, you're willing to listen to rumors, shmumas. And here I want to show you something that I had tremendous, tremendous nachat. I cannot put a price on what the Sichat HaShavua did for me. 2 little articles. One is outside the lecture, but I'll come to the other one in a second, which is within the lecture. Outside the lecture, who was the first one in the world to speak about the fact that we have to build mikvot on every army base? No, Morty, where did you hear it? Right here in this room, in this class, this Rebbe. Everyone listening, laughing at me, but we're going to have Hasidic soldiers. I felt very bad when I read in Bamachaneh that I have to wake up 4:00 in the morning to go to mikveh in Mishon Lezion because Tzrifin doesn't have a mikveh. They built a mikveh in Tzrifin. Here is a Jew who devotes himself to building mikvot on army bases. I don't know if he heard it from me, but Baruch Hashem, 2 of us, a Litvak and a Chabadnik, both reach the same conclusion. What's important for this lecture is when you look at the website, everyone is against the computer. They held the rally, 80,000 people, 90,000, I don't know how many turned out to see Tanaka pitch. The most that have turned out are like 52,000, but a rally against the computer. Believe me, I would go to see Tanaka pitch. A rally against the computer, I don't want to waste my time. To see Tanaka pitch, that's medicine. You're a kid again. All your worries are over. Wow. That is a chiyuv d'oraita. V'shmatem l'nafshel teichem. You're the only kid who grew up in Boston and doesn't know Ted Williams' statistics. Right or wrong? The only kid. How many home runs did he hit? 525. What's his lifetime average? 344. What could he do when a baseball came in? He could read the writing on the baseball. That's 1 out of 500,000 people have that type of eyesight. You know what the American government did to him because he had that eyesight? One of the few people flew planes World War II and the Korean War. He was called up twice. You have any idea what we're talking about? So, but why the computer? So they're rallying against the computer. Pornography, murder, drugs. Look, life is choice. Women exist, men exist, murder exists, robbery exists, drugs exist, cigarettes, it all is there. Liquor, you gotta teach a kid. My grandchildren will testify when they were very young. I used to carry on with them. You guys get everything. Your grandfather will buy you anything you want. You're gonna be drug addicts. You're gonna go for dope. You have everything in life. Blah, 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 blah. And the kids, I said, so now when they're in their 20s and hitting 30 and they're such beautiful Jews, such beautiful human beings, I say, you see, I let you know at an early age, that's what life is about. But I'll tell you why I'm opposed to the computer. Do you see the Haredi websites? Do you see the Lashon Hara, the Rechilit, the Sinat Achim? I don't want to mention some of the websites you can plot. Baruch Hashem, the lead article in Sichat Hayom, Afshal Hadbir et HaVirus, Rakefet being quoted word by word. What is wrong with a computer? Gentlemen, in 1941, many of the students in Yeshiva and Yeshiva College believed every type of Lashon Hara, every type of Rechilit, every type of enmity, hatred, gossip. Kids eat it up. I'm all right. I'm all holy. I'm all white. You're black, you're a Goynish, you're an Oislop. They believed it. And it affects the history of Yeshiva University until this very moment. Fortunately, it became a great blessing, although at the time, it was an unbelievable curse, as you will see. Let us begin with that introduction. Don't forget any word I said today, because we're not going to come back to it and I'm going to be gone 2 weeks. But when we do come back to it, you'll understand this introduction in a very tangible, unbelievable fashion. Gentlemen, the first candidate, the most logical candidate, the one who should have become president, the second president of the yeshiva, the man who should have succeeded, Rabbi Revel, if life would work with common sense. Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. Rabbi Young was a personality that to have known him was to have known greatness. He was a very unique personality. His years, 1892-1987, he was Seichel Arichat Yomim Tofen. Born in what was Moravia, has been part of Hungary, part of Galicia, that part of Europe that changed hands many times. Essentially Hungarian, studied in Hungary, studied in Germany. His father became a rabbi in London. This is very important because Rabbi Leo Young spent his formative years in London, was a graduate of the university, had a doctorate, had smicha, which he picked up from Rabbi Cook when Rabbi Cook lived in London during World War I, 1916 to 1918, picked up smicha from Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman and Hildesheimers when he went back to Germany to study where his father had studied for a while, considered that his most important smicha, had smicha from Hungarian Rabbanim, but in London, his father established an organization, I believe it was called the Sinai League. Now, a few words about this organization. What was London all about? British Jewry was always more traditional than America. Traditional in the sense that you're living in a world where there's a queen, where there's a king, a world which is conservative with a small c, so that the average synagogue in the British Empire, and this is until today, whether it's England, South Africa, Australia, the average synagogue was built in accordance with tradition, had a balcony, had a mechitza, had a women's section, but most of the Jews were assimilating. And assimilating at that time meant Chilul Shabbos, breakdown in kashrut, kosher at home, not kosher outside of the house. In later years, and today lo aleinu, intermarriage, assimilation. Sinai League was, I would put it this way, an English version of Young Israel. Bring the youth together to study, to socialize, to see that Judaism is relevant. And here you come into one of the selling points, if we look back to what Young Israel was all about, and later Rabbi Young, the Jewish Center in New York. Look back. What were they trying to tell us? Judaism is modern, up to date. Don't have to be ashamed to be a Shomer Shabbos. So many benefits to be gained from leading a Jewish life. Give you a simple example. In London, in the mid-30s, and this can be checked out, they did research why religious Jews live longer than the rest of the population. And there were statistics, whatever the statistics were, that the average person in the British Empire or living in Great Britain or living in London lived to be 57, a religious Jew lived to be 68. And there were all types of theories proposed. And the theory that was popularized was by taking off one day a week, we remove ourselves from tension. And they did experiments, unbelievable experiments. When the phone rings, they hooked up your body to mechanisms to record what happens to your blood pressure when the phone rings. Now think about this. The phone rings, you jump, you run, you answer. Well, they're calling you with news, there may be problems, may be bad news. Once again, your body suffers. Ah, when you take off Shabbos, no phone. You disconnect the phone. You're sitting at home. No phone, no interruptions, no bad news. And you see, developing this whole theme that to be an observant Jew, to live with Torah, is not just modern. It's wonderful. It's healthy. It's good. It's inspiring. It gives purpose to life. This was the Sinai League. Yitzchak, you're listening carefully? Think about how the Rav would react to this. I'll mention it later. But I want you to understand Rabbi Young. And Rabbi Young's father was a leader of Agudat Yisrael. Rabbi Young, Rabbi Leo Young would become a leader of Agudat Yisrael for a certain period. Now, let me talk about Agudat Yisrael for a moment. You have to put it into context. I gave lectures on Zionism, Agudat Yisrael, a number of years ago, but those are very powerful, important lectures. You see, when Agudat Yisrael was organized, what are we talking about? Chaim Meiselman, who's not here, and I miss him, convey that message to him, sent me a link where Manish Tana, an American, the late 1920s, the Yoni, you saw it, I see you laughing, the Manish Tana, why is it in America that everyone assimilates, but in Europe everyone is from? So someone writes in, a blogger writes in, where's everyone from in Europe? I got news for you. By the late 1920s, there was Chilul Shabbos all over every community, including Vilna. Lo aleinu, the frum Jew was at a minority. We were losing all over the place. So against this world, Agudat Yisrael was formed. The original idea behind Agudat Yisrael was denied all religious Jews. The idea of Agudat Yisrael began before World War I. What happened was World War One broke out. That's how Rav Kook got stranded in Europe. He traveled for the Aguda Convention. World War One broke out. He couldn't go home. There are other people like that too. By the time Aguda started functioning in 1919, they made the decision that if you are a Zionist, if you believe that Jews can get sovereignty in the land of Israel before the coming of Mashiach, you are an apikairis, and you cannot be a member of Agudat Israel. And that was their decision. Now, I need not tell you that the Eidah Haredit never lets them live it down. If you read Hachoma, you will see time and again the Eidah Haredit reminds Agudat Israel, who revoked your decision? Who gave you permission to join the government and be part of the Israeli state? But that was a decision Agudat Israel made, which obviously excluded the Mizrahiites. Nevertheless, there were many open, broad-minded Jews who loved the idea of unity, and they were involved in Agudat Yisrael, and both Rabbi Young and his father were involved in Agudat Yisrael. Sinai League had an interaction with Agudat Yisrael. It was only after the formation of the State of Israel, when Agudah remained askance, people like Rabbi Leo Young became Poliagudniks. And Poli Aguda became a very powerful organization in the 40s into the 50s into the 60s. It attracted people who were, again, to use popular language, by and large were frummer than the Mizrahiites. In other words, what do I mean frummer? I won't mention the name of the family, but a great Rab's family. So his daughter-in-law showed me a picture of a get-together of the family of the 1940s in Eretz Yisrael. And the women are sleeveless. And she said, we all went that way. No one said a word to us. The grandfather was a Godel Sheba Gedolim, is sitting there. In Agud, the women didn't go sleeveless. They maybe went. We have pictures in America. They went with half sleeves, but not sleeveless. And they covered their hair, you see. So they were frumma. But over the years, you see what happened here. The Mizrahiites of today, the Chadalnikim, are just as frumma as the Agudistim. I mean, who wears longer sleeves? Who, my granddaughter wears a skirt. She's an Upana girl. They wear skirts down to their stockings. You can't get any more tsanua, thank God. And they all cover their hair. So today, Poli Aguda either their children went into Panovich, went right wing, or they wound up in the greater Mizrahi movement, which is taking the place of Poli Aguda. But a person like Leo Young, when he came to America, when all this was germinated within him, the Sinai League, modernity, reaching out, he was an Agudist in the 20s into the 30s. He arrives in America in 1920, and he goes to Cleveland. And in Cleveland, he is a phenomenon because he is, number one, an Orthodox rabbi with a PhD who speaks English, the King's English at that time, not yet the Queen's English, and he has a beard. Now, you don't understand. You guys are sitting here with beards, with payas. My generation, who had a beard? Like I'll let you in on a secret now. And Rakefet is an eyewitness, not Rakefet, Rothkopf, Ani Rothkopf, an ear witness and an eyewitness. Ellie, I'm not making it up. I had a chaver, a classmate, Izzy Perlmutter. Izzy Perlmutter lives in Yerushalayim. He's a psychologist. No, who knows Izzy Perlmutter? My daughter knows him from the Buddha's Inn. He testifies exactly my age. We were bosom buddies. Is Israel Perlmutter. Can anyone tell me who his grandfather was? No? Anybody. Reb Chaim Chelop was Izzy Perlmutter's grandfather. I believe I write in Washington. I first learned what an Adam Gadol is when I was playing punch ball with Izzy Perlmutter outside the yeshiva building during the summer on Amsterdam Avenue. And the Rav, I couldn't believe it. I was a kid in high school, MTA, where you went, where I went. The Rav comes over, Yisrael, Ayazay de Veltaichzen. And he takes Izzy Perlmutter by the hand to the Bernard Revel Graduate School, where Reb Chaim Heller was giving lectures. His grandfather wanted to see his grandson. That's Izzy Perlmutter. I can tell you that Izzy Perlmutter began to grow a beard. Mr. Abram sent for Israel Perlmutter and told Israel Perlmutter, today is Thursday, Sunday you will only be allowed into class if your beard is off your face. Quote, end quote. That's in MTA, that's in high school. I'd like to see today a Rebbe tell the kids you can't get into class because you have a beard. And this was your Chaim Michalis an anical. We're not talking a kid like Rothko who found out he had yichus when he was in his 70s already. Rakefet discovered he has the biggest yichus in the world. But that's a different story. This is the incredible of Chaim Michalis anical. It's unbelievable, but that was America. Wow, you have a bearded guy, a PhD, an English speaker. Now, then there's another problem. And I've seen it time and again with my students, and it would have happened to me had I remained in America. I would have been in Amoritz, that goes for sure, I still would have remained a Yorei B'Shalem, I hope, but it would have happened to me. Every Rav is not happy to be in Cleveland, he's not happy to be in Detroit, he's not happy to be in Boston. He wants the only one later in life who didn't want to go to New York was the Rav for personal reasons. We can talk about it someday. I've spoken about it in the past. But every Rav you want to get where the action is. It's like I asked a good Jew this morning who just moved from a city called Rehovot to Yerushalayim. I said, how was Pesach in Yerushalayim? It's like he was reborn. He never had an experience in Yerushalayim. So when I attended a memorial for Rabbi Galinsky, it's a year since his death, Sechet Tzadik Lefracha, Thursday night. So there were people came in for the memorial, and the shul looks like a shack. People asked me, is this the Shtiblach of Katamon? You know, it's like a shack. I said, the Shtiblach is a block and a half away, but to walk there, you pass about four or five other shuls to Yerushalayim. What do you want? So every rabbi wants to get to New York. Sometimes you get to New York, you succeed. Sometimes the heartache is unbelievable. You would have been a lot happier had you remained in Cleveland. I can give many tangible examples. But let me not talk about New York. I'll talk about Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan Spector. Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan Spector, Tzich Bakluk, he used to cry. Why was I stupid enough to take the Kovna Rabbinate? Where was he Rav before Kovna? Nevadik. Had I remained in Nevadik, I could have been like Rabbi Yechira, like my successor, Rabbi Yechira Michal Epstein. I would have written endless Sfarim, Aruch HaShulchan, Halacha L'Maisa. I came to Kovna where every minute of the day I'm bothered by endless problems. So, it's not always so good, but still the Yetzer Hara, the Yetzer HaTov. I want to get to Brooklyn, I want to get to Manhattan, I want to get to Riverdale. I want to get to the five towns. That's where the action is. Teaneck, Englewood, come on, you understand it? Who heard about a rabbi in Cleveland but a rabbi in Englewood? Teaneck, these are the leaders of the Torah world. So 2 years later, the Jewish Center brings the rabbi to New York. Now, you have to understand what the Jewish Center was all about. When you talk about elegant Orthodox synagogues, the Jewish Center represented the synthesis of an Orthodox Jew, a lot of yekis at the time, by the way, a lot of you, I'm positive you have yekis, I have yekis through my grandchildren, that we interrelate with a lot of people who were in the Jewish Center. They made it in America. It was a shul of dignity, decorum, Americanization, but a shul that was from Leo Young. If ever there was a perfect rabbi fit for a shul, it was Rabbi Leo Young and the Jewish Center. A perfect fit. Dignity. Dedication. Americanization. The Mechitza in the Jewish Center, I don't know today, is it still the same Mechitza? Who's been in the Jewish Center recently? But in my time, in Rabbi Young's time, Rabbi Lamb's time, Rabbi J.J. Schachter's time, I davened there over the years a few times. It wasn't exactly a machitza that you would be happy with in Yerushalayim. Let me assure you that Merkaz Arach people would not daven with such a machitza lachatchila. But it represented, okay, it was a kosher machitza, b'diavad, according to shitat, etc., etc. I don't have to give a shir now on a machitza, the size, Rav Moshe, the Satmar Rebbe, the Rav, all that went into the American machitza, the battle, etc. But it was a perfect sheikh. Now, I must add, the balabatim of the Jewish center, you didn't live on the Upper West Side if you were... It's the memorial siren for the 6 million. Yom HaShoah here. It's part of us, part of our life, the newspapers, the stories. Wow. I read in it probably was in Yediot, the weekend, the Friday edition, the problem we've dealt with in class, the ability to rebuild after going through such horror. It was a Rav's daughter who survived. And she left a notebook, her daughter, she's no longer alive, but her daughter only discovered the notebook recently, and how she says, despite everything we went through, but I won't let them take away my faith. I'm a Rav's HaTachta. And she succeeded here in raising a family, L'Kavod U'L'Tiferet. Ultimately, that's our greatest Nekama against Hitler. The latest issue of Bamachane, the Army Weekly, has a major article on soldiers who descend from Nazis, IDF soldiers who descend from Nazis. I have in my own family like that, where a German boy came to Israel and to expiate the sins of his people, became Jewish, married a girl from Yerushalayim, related to me through marriage, and lives in Bnei Brak. You can fill in the rest of the story, how many children and grandchildren, kulam shomrei Torah mitzvah. And he made a good living all the years as a German correspondent for German newspapers, their Israeli reporter. It's a very fascinating article in Bamachaneh. Now, coming back here, so it's not only he became rabbi, but he had the good fortune to pick up someone very quickly who becomes again, these people deserve so much credit for what they did. They were pioneers. The name Joseph Kamenetsky mean anything to you? Joe Kamenetsky was a member of the first Yeshiva College graduating class. And he picked up Joe Kamenetsky to head up the Talmud Torah in Jewish Center. Yosef Kamenetsky was an educator par excellence. And it's like I told many people, including Cholomoitz Pesach, I met with people, to teach, you have to be a born teacher, a born educator. You can take a course to improve yourself. But if you don't have that love of youngsters, of children, you're never going to succeed. And Joe Kamenetsky was it. Out of that Talmud Torah in the Jewish Center comes what today is Manhattan Day School. You follow? So that right away you not only have a synagogue, you have a day school at a very early time in America, and once again a day school that is not impoverished. You don't get to Jewish Center being a schnorrer. These are people of means, people of wealth, people who give tzedakah. This place is a powerhouse. Now, Joe Kamenetsky later goes on, the whole Toru Mesorah is a result of Joe Kamenetsky. And even when the right wing, so-called, takes over American Orthodoxy, Rabbi Aaron Kotler and everyone else have to make their peace with Joe Kamenetsky. Member of the 1932 first graduating class of Yeshiva College, which began in 1928. So, this Rabbi Young continues, mikvah. You have no idea what the story of mikvah is about. Did I tell the story yesterday in class? Like, who was here? Yosef Mordechai told the story about the letter I had to write Machon Gold yesterday in class with Reb Menashe Klein. I told the story. What was mikvah in America? My wife yet went to the original mikvah in South Philadelphia. It was a horror story. Where the mikveh was located, the people who sat outside gambling, playing cards, smoking drugs. God have mercy what women were subjected to. Rabbi Young began a tremendous campaign, hygienically and aesthetically, on the heights of Judaism. This is the way a mikveh has to be. He was responsible for some 15 aesthetic and modern mikvahot in America. They quote from his writings. He was a prolific writer. I can remember a number of loathsome places, and I cannot criticize too sharply the carelessness which made such conditions possible. Coupled with the inability of the rabbis to discuss this all-important subject. Again, sneers. How can you get up? How can you get up and preach in public about the mikvah, about the cycle of life? And with a lack of informed rebellion against among women who should have refused to get married before the community established decent mikvah, the situation which prevailed rendered such hostility on the part of the half-informed and uninformed young women more intelligible. And all right, this is a man who understands what's going on in America, who understands how can an American girl go to a mikveh which is in a tragic location, a tragic state, or to quote Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, when he describes Frankfurt, which he came to in the early 1850s, he says, where the mikveh was located, I'm quoting Rav Hirsch now, quote, it was a passage fit only for swine to walk through, not Jewish women, end quote. Rabbi Young became very involved with the nascent Beit Yaakov movement in America. And he, more than anyone else, the famous story of the 93 Beis Yaakov girls who sacrifice their lives rather than submit to the barbarians, to the Gestapo, to the Germans. He was the one who publicized that story. Now, I need not tell you, we spoke about it in great detail many years ago in the Sunday class within the context of Shalat and Shuvat Halacha during the Shoah, that it actually happened, didn't it happen? That remains an open issue until today. Rabbi J.J. Schachter and others have written about it, but Rakefet has one simple approach. It doesn't matter whether it happened or didn't happen. It could have happened, and we as good Jews can believe every word of the story of the 93, because these were the type of girls that came out of Beis Yaakov. And Rabbi Young publicized, raised money, got his congregation involved, later becomes very active for Poli Agudat Yisrael, very active for Kibbutz Chafetz Chaim. There is no end to what he does to help Yiddishkeit thrive. He coined the famous expression, which all of us who were his students, and there are two of us in this room that I know of who studied with him, and we all heard this from his mouth, the three R's of Judaism: reverence, righteousness, and rachmanut, as only he could pronounce it with a slight German overtone. And I could go on and on reading the beautiful thoughts, the crowning quality in Rachmanut, for which there is no word in the English language. Rachmanut is usually translated as mercy or compassion, but etymologically it means mother's love. The unselfish, dedicated love of a mother for her little one, her passionate desire to spend herself for the purpose of raising her baby from helpless infancy towards self-sufficient maturity. And Rachmanut Yiddishkeit, Rachmanut between man and God, Rachmanut between parents and children, he put Yiddishkeit into beautiful, modern, sophisticated, tame terms. He was not monolithic. He could be very open-minded. He could accept Agudat Yisrael. He could accept Poli Agudat. He could accept Mizrahi. He could accept Yeshiva University. He could accept all the major issues of the time, as long as it was built upon Torah Tashem Tamima. Give me one more second. He struck up a friendship with a very interesting individual, Hermann Wouk. All of you know the name Hermann Wouk from the many novels he wrote. Hermann Wouk's magnum opus, in my feeling, is a book that he wrote as a result of his friendship with Rabbi Young. This is my God. And I highly, highly recommend that volume. It gives you insight to Rabbi Young, to American Orthodoxy, circa 1950s, and there's a lot of material in there which is eternal. And I'll give you just one little example from Hermann Wouk. Hermann Wouk's grandfather was a Rav in the Bronx. Hermann Wouk, like many of the other children of his time, looked at his grandfather as ancient, out of date, outlandish, threw it all away, and later in life served in the Navy, started to ask questions, came under the influence of such individuals like Rabbi Leo Young. Hermann Wouk tells his story that his grandfather was teaching in the shul in the Bronx, not far from where I grew up, and he's teaching about Balei Tshuva and how a Baal Tshuva, everything out of the past is erased. And in the shul, there were a few Balabatim who had been from all their lives. And they wanted to argue with the rabbi. Rebbe, we can design if you give a machal Shabbos and I clean the veils and treifes at all skipant was mentonish. And with all that background, and you mean to say he's equal to me today? And the rabbi said yes. It was his mother's father, the rabbi. The rabbi said yes. And wanted to encourage Balei Tshuva, obviously. When they got home, the little grandson, who was a teenager, says to his Zayda, you know, they asked you a good question. I don't understand it. Someone is from all his life, and his life book is equal to the Mechalel Shabbos? Eichlin Ebedet and Treifat in his old age became a Shema Shabbos? And his grandfather said, look, I didn't want to discourage. The crowd there was mainly people I want to become Balei Tshuva, but I'll tell you the real answer. He says, yes. Guy is 75 years old. He's a Mechalel Shabbos 70 years. 71st year becomes a Shema Shabbos. So 70 pages in his book are blank. The last 5 are written in golden letters. But ein avos es given a Shema Shabbos an ganz leben. He has 75 pages in golden letters. That's Herman Wuk. That's Rabbi Young. That's the Jewish center. Yes, Yitzchak, before I go further.
Our generation, which is 3 generations removed from him, has no idea, because of the amount of, the vast amount of literature that comes out every week by different rabbis and
right.
In the 1930s, 1940s, there was nothing written by Orthodox rabbis about Judaism. There was a book by Herbius Goldstein on the,
the
English version of Sefer Chinuch.
Right.
There was very little. There was later on the Spiro Foundation, which was in the 50s. But in the 1940s,
the 30s, the 40s, the Jewish library, this was Leo Young, single-handedly.
He was the only one.
Single-handedly. Now, this description of Rabbi Young is right on. I alluded to something a half hour ago that Yitzchak and I both understood. The Rav would not have been happy with this type of understanding of Torah. To quote Rabbi Rachman, Rabbi Rachman has pointed out that Rabbi Young's approach to religion is called a psychological approach, as this approach analyzes religion with peace of mind and happy and noble living as its end. And this is exactly, if you take Rav Hirsch, you take German Orthodoxy, you take Rabbi Young, you can reach this level of understanding of what Torah is about. Is this correct? Can very well be correct. Is this a goal to strive for? Absolutely. The Rav couldn't tolerate it. Why? Because on a psychological level, there is so much negative in the world, so much struggle, so much stress, so much tension. The Rav was very unhappy when you reviewed Torah as peace of mind. A book came out, what was it, in the 40s, a Reform rabbi who wrote it, and it was a bestseller, peace of mind, and the Rav would go crazy attacking that volume, and the Rav would stress again and again, what does religion mean? We have difficulties, we have challenges, we have problems. Why are we allowed to pray? Mimamakim karaticha Hashem. Because a person is always in stress, there's always tension, there are always questions you can't answer. The religious personality is always challenged. It's two different worlds here, you see? The Rav went crazy. I'll give you another example, which is a direct result of Rabbi Leo Young the OU, and what Yitzchak said. We're now going back to the late 40s, the early 50s, Ellie, they're just beginning to put out literature. And there was an OU, a pamphlet, more than a pamphlet, maybe 30 pages on the beauty of Shabbat. And it describes the lady putting out the white tablecloth. And the Rav went crazy. The white table, this is Shabbat. To the Rav, what was Shabbat? Lamed Tet Malachet and Allah Lamdis and Reb Chaim and Elisha Yurim and Bore and Kotzer and Tochem and how you're allowed. The Rav Shabbat was a very different Shabbat than a white tablecloth. As a matter of fact, I'm positive the Rav with Nachpasel in Borough Park, they say, they ask if you make a shidduch, I don't know if it's true. Do you cover the tablecloth with plastic? In other words, that it has to be white is a given, but they want to know if you cover with the plastic. I have, what's wrong with covering in plastic if it makes life easier for your wife that she doesn't have to wash the tablecloth every week? I still don't understand why they ask such a stupid question. And if you read the Boston Rebbe's wife's memoirs, what it told me, her name is Rachel. Rachel Twesky, you read the memoirs, she says, Rebbetzin Soloveitchik saved my life. Horowitz, what did I say? Mixing up dynasties. Horowitz, that Twesky's in their blood, take my word for it. So if you read the Boston Rebbetzin's memoirs, she says, Rebbetzin Tanya Soloveitchik saved her life. And then she tells the story. What happened? There was a young couple came to Boston at the university and became very close to the Boston Rebbe, and they became frum, and they also knew the Rav. And the Rav invited them Shabbos lunch to his house. So after they ate at the Rav and they came back to the Rebbe, to the Boston Rebbe, the Rebbetzin, they asked, tell us about what it was like at the Rav's house. So he gave a description, the Rav, the Divrei Torah, the grandchildren, and he said what was amazing was they used fancy paper plates. So after Shabbos, the Boston Rebbetzin called the Boston Rav's wife and said, tell me, you use paper plates? She said, yeah, because my husband gives shir after Shabbos, and I don't have time to, you know, the famous Saturday night shir in Boston, which the documentary on the Rebbe's life that I was privileged to bring into the world, you have so much about it in there. And at that famous shir, I write about it in the Rebbe, at that famous shir, I don't have time to wash dishes, so we have to go right after Shabbos, so I use paper. She said she saved my life. Until then, they used to use regular dishes. There was endless washing. People used to come in to help. They started buying cartons and cartons of paper goods, and Baruch Hashem, she saved my life. Well, in Borough Park today, the Boston Rebbetzin couldn't get a shidduch because she used paper goods on Shabbos. I have to tell you, I am guilty. What makes it easier for your wife? Wow, it's mamash achi of the oraita, gemilat chesed. Okay, but you see, this was the Judaism of Rabbi Dr. Leo Young.
But the Rav did say that his father learned what not to do on Shabbos.
Right, and his mother learned how to observe Shabbos, the spirit. But this was Leo Young. He taught ethics and homiletics at Yeshiva University, where he influenced the graduates to create an urban, moral, and dignified orthodoxy.
He called it social engineering.
Now, this was Rabbi Young. He was the most logical and prime candidate for the position. He had the balabatim. He had the money behind him. Many of the Jewish center people were among the biggest contributors to what becomes Yeshiva University. I don't have to go any further than the Lamport family, the Lamport Auditorium, $100,000 plus $100,000, money that was given in the 1920s. He had big balabatim behind him. If I'm not mistaken, the Gottesman family was also from the west side. The Fischel family already was from the east side. But if I'm not mistaken, the Gottesman family too was from the west side. And he was a man of dignity, a man with knowledge, a PhD, but as Nishkeven al Litvisha, the knowledge of al Litvisha Rosh Yeshiva, what we're talking about, the Soloveitchik family, Reb Shimon Shkop, the Mechita, Yeshiva and Yeshiva College, the students were used to a different type of Torah, a different type of gestalt, a different type of outlook. Now remember, let's just go back in time for a minute. Rabbi Revel did many great things, but in my humble opinion, the greatest thing that Rabbi Revel did should be celebrated on September 1st, September 1st, 1922, a Bal Takht in New York, and Rav Shlomo Palachek, the Mechita Ilui, the man for whom the street is named right next to Mekas Harav, Rechov HaIlui, arrived in America for one reason, to teach Torah. And why did Rabbi Revel go after him? Why did Rabbi Revel bring him over? Because he wanted the yeshiva to be on a level that no one in the world could put yeshiva and yeshiva college down, that no one in the world could say it's an American institution. No, this is not just an American institution. This is a home of learning that continues the traditions of Voloshin, Slabodka, Telz, Mir, and the Mechita was the Mechita. Alright, there are reasons why he left Europe. No one wanted to leave Europe permanently. But the Mechita had become a Mizrachiite. And as the Mechita himself said to the Mir Rosh Yeshiva in 26, when Blasi Yehuda Finkel visited America, and Blasi Yehuda says to the Mechita, why did you leave Europe? You would today be the most famous Rosh Yeshiva in Europe. And the Mechita answered, had I remained in Europe, I would still have to have one foot in America. So the Mir Rosh Yeshiva looked at him, what do you mean? He says, because of my hashkafas as a Mizrahi, I couldn't continue in Europe. My chaverim would put me into cherim. So the Mechita came to America. Then Reb Shimon Shkop, when the Mechita died, Reb Shimon was in America. Reb Shimon, Rabbi Belkin wanted him to remain permanently. He gave him $10,000 a year, $4,000 to live on, $6,000 to send to Gorodno for his yeshiva. But I told you, I can absolutely tell you these are the facts. I spoke with Rav Shmuel Belkin. I mean, there's so many theories given why he went back. He went, Rav Shmuel Belkin told me why. Because the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Chaim Moser sent him a letter that Grodno is disappearing if you're not there. Your son and son-in-law are not the same as you. And he had to go back. So then he brought, or Rabbi Rebel brings Rav Moshe Soloveitchik to America. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim's son, this is Bris, this is Voloshin. Wow! This is not German Orthodoxy. This is an entirely different derech, an entirely different approach. This is not the Jewish center. It's a different world. And the students were captivated. And now you have another candidate, Mori Urebi, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the son of Reb Moshe. Now, a few words on the Reb's background. As you know, I lectured in my Monday morning class 22 years on the Reb. My two volumes on the Reb grew out of that class. And my two volumes, I limit myself to quoting the Rav in his own words about his life. And those two volumes give you a fairly good picture of the Rav. What's amazing about the Rav, he was exposed to so many different levels in his life. He grows up Pruzhana Brisk, Reb Chaim, Reb Moshe, Voloshin, Mitvish. His father becomes Rabbi in Chaslovich, White Russia. Chabad. It's beyond words. The Rav, I was told by ear witnesses, eyewitnesses, in the 1970s, 80s, he's davening in the Beis Medrash, Mincha, and they hear the Rav say, in the Salon Shmon Esrei, Sim Shalom. Talmidim went over to him, Rebbe, what are you saying, Sim Shalom? Yal Litvak, Shalom Rav. They didn't, alright, the Gon Shita, when you read the Torah at Mincha, you say Sim Shalom. But outside of that, you say Shalom Rav. And the Gaon and Rebbe answered. The Rav answered, "What kind of question are you asking me? I grew up in Chaslovich. I mean, it's unbelievable. Now, had the students had every seichel, they should have gone one step further and asked him, Rebbe, you daven Nusach Ari? But they didn't ask him. You follow? I asked him, why didn't you press him further? Sim Shalom. But he said, well, what are you getting so upset about? I grew up in Chaslovich. Then he goes to Warsaw. He goes to Warsaw after World War I. Where does he live? I quote the Rav. Read the Rav. Read my, I write there word by word. It's not Rakefet. It's Rakefet quoting the Rav. Word by word. I give you the source. What tape I got it from. The Rav says, where did we live? The poorest neighborhood. Who lived in the poor neighborhood? The Gera Chassidim, the Majus the Chassidim. Where did the Rav daven? The stories I tell, it's all, and a Majus the Shtibel, a Gera Shtibel. Read the Rav talking about his life. Then he goes to Berlin. I need not tell you what Berlin was. German Orthodoxy, Torim Derech Eretz, Hildesheimers. Scientific Jewish scholarship, Chochmat Yisrael, Wissenschaft des Judentum. Right or wrong? My last conversation with the Rav, 1983, about the manuscripts he was looking at in the Berlin library, manuscripts Kitvei Rishonim for his uncle, the Avodas HaMelech, who had a scientific approach, Rav Menachem Karakovsky. It's my last conversation with the Rav. The Rav was exposed. I don't know of any other Gadol. Take Rabbi Aaron Kotler, take Rabbi Eliezer Menachem Manshach, take any name you throw out. Alright, they were Litvish. Maybe a little exposure to Chassidut. But that's it. The Rav, the only thing he wasn't exposed to was Sfadik Jewry. Alright? He didn't know Rav Adya. He met Rav Adya Yosef later in the 70s, but the Sfadik Jewry, he knew from afar. He didn't know it up in close, intimately. But our entire Ashkenazic rainbow or mosaic, call it what you wish, the Litvish Welt, the Hasidish Welt, and the subdivisions in the Hasidish Welt, Lo Harei Chabad, Kimo Ger, the Lo Harei Chabad V'Gur, Kimo Majitz. Nachon alone, you're dealing here with different worlds. And then German Orthodoxy, with all that it had to offer. And remember, he knew Rav Meir Hildesheimer. He knew Rav Azriel Hildesheimer. But Rav Meir, because Rav Azriel is the next generation. He knew Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. I mean, think for a moment. He knew Rav Avraham Yoshua Heschel. He knew Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson in Berlin. It's beyond words. He knew Rav Chaim Heller from Berlin. With what? All this exposure. But it was never difficult to understand the Rav. See, the Rav remained a Litvak. He had extra layers on him. Icing on the cake. But it was icing on the cake. The basic personality was a Litvak. He remained a Voloshiner, he remained a Briska. Do you read me well? In other words, very different for the sake of Wagner, Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. How many of you are familiar with Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg? All right, I happen, whatever the reasons, I know Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg inside out. Read the Sri Deyesh. The Sri Deyesh, very hard to define him. That he was a Litvak, he was a Litvak. But at times he could be a total scientific scholar. 100%. At times he could be critical of the very world that raised him and which he loved. But the man had many facets within him that struggled with each other. You want the proof? I'll prove it to you very easily. Out of a room at the end of this hall in the early 80s, a Rebbe was teaching by the name of Dr. Rakefet. That's it, that he always used his doctorate to give credit to BMT that they had. Doctors teaching, big deal. Anyway, I'm talking about Rebbe Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. A kid is sitting right over there, blonde hair, little kid, 18, 19 years of age. Little did I dream, he hears about Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. He writes in his introduction to his doctor, goes on to do a doctorate at Harvard under Professor Yitzchak Tversky. Okay? And he writes that I first heard about from my Rebbe and etc. The doctorate comes out, brilliant work. You should see the attack upon him. Wow. Diane Berkowitz, Sikrona Levracha from London, Talmud Rebbe Field. But what was the heart of the attack? The heart of the attack. Of course, Rabbi Chiyuv Yaakov was many people rolled into one. It's hard to portray him accurately, because at moments he could be the Litvisha Yeshiva boy, which he loved and admired. And at moments, he was total Berlin, totally westernized, totally modern European. The Rav can say what you want. People have said about a certain two volumes, I don't want to mention the author and the name of the volumes now, it's the most accurate description of the Rav. So the person who said this happens to be a descendant of the Rav. So they asked him, what do you mean? He says, everyone pulls the Rav right or left. The one who describes him as he was is my classmate Arnie, a guy named Arnie Rothkopf. That's absolutely so. Rothkopf quotes the Rav word by word. You don't have to pull the Rav right or left, because it's clear who the Rav was. He remained a Litvak with all the added layers of icing, and only an idiot will deny the fact that he went to graduate school, he had a doctorate, he was a philosopher, he had broad vision, he embraced the Western world, to quote Yudidi Rabaron Lichtenstein, he embraced the Western world with 10 fingers. Absolutely true. But the basic gestalt was Litvish. So you see, here you have two candidates. One who represents an orthodoxy that has conquered America. An orthodoxy that has built beautiful modern aesthetic mikvot. And you have a man who is a gonadir, part of the American scene, Americanizing, westernizing, but at his core, no different than Reb Moshe, than Reb Shimon, than the Mechita Ili, two candidates. Let me end off with the big fly in the ointment. I'll give you sources next time, Be'ezrat Hashem. But the students had one big problem with the Rav. When the Rav came to America, he had one idol, one role model, a man by the name Reb Lazer Silva. Reb Lazer Silva, when the Rav came to America, had just gone from Springfield, Massachusetts to Cincinnati, Ohio, the president of the Agudas Harabanim. The Rav, and this I can tell you, I'm repeating what the Rav told me. I mean, I'm absolutely on here. Forget about my scholarship. I'm not guessing now. I'm telling as a fact. The Rav loved Reb Lazer Silva, a Litvisha Talmud Chacham, who became a real Rav with influence, power on the American scene. So far, so good. They became very close. The Rav becomes a Rav in Boston, a member of the Agudas HaRabbanim. But what was the Agudas HaRabbanim involved with? Hechsherim, Kashrut. If they had computers at that time, every website would have been filled with stories of phonies of pumpernickel breads being sold on Pesach with kosher le Pesach labels. Okay? These were the jokes that made the rounds. Every website would have been filled with endless stories, some which unfortunately were true. The majority were probably not true. You all know until today we have terrible stories. Just yesterday, the police announced that they're indicting a very prominent Rav who I happen to know personally. He, you know, I know him from the army. He was the Rav HaRashi of Chel Avir, and I lectured for him a number of times.
He's on the radio every morning.
He's
the most wonderful Shia.
Right. Malei v'gadish, and a mensch, and he's a mensch. Alright, they're indicting him. I don't know. It sounds to me like they have him. These charges are true. You get involved with kashrut. You get involved with money. This is before the OU. If anyone ever says a bad word about the OU, smack them, put them into formaldehyde, and just throw them into the ground and tell them you wake them up when they do tshuva. The OU is one of our greatest contributions. By the way, among the people who helped build the OU was Rabbi Young, Rabbi Goldstein, people of this ilk, people of this stature. Kashrut is a public trust. Kashrut is not a way for individuals to make a living. But all these rumors, all these stories reach the students at yeshiva. And there were those who loved the Rav, and those who had enmity towards his reputation. The last thing in the world we want is a Yerupeyish Rav involved with kashrut, involved with scandals, involved with under the desk deals, involved with the illegal transfer of money. And you see two candidates. Each one has tremendous positive qualifications, and each one has a certain drawback. And a battle is beginning, to use modern Hebrew, teku ephes, ephes. Believe me, when I grew up, I had no idea. If someone would have said to me, teku ephes, ephes, I would have said, what the heck are you talking about? But having lived in Israel for 45 years, it means the game is called because of darkness. It is a tie score. Teku, nothing. Interesting the way the Israelis are so from Kanayin Hara that even when they play soccer, they quote from the Gemara. Teku, ephes, ephes. Gentlemen, what a machloker is beginning. And I want you to think about, imagine had the Rav been elected president, what would have become of the Rav? When I grew up, there were still cynics on the street who said, and I quote, and I end off this part of the class, had Rabbi Young been elected, there would be no yeshiva. They mean no Litvishi yeshiva. It would have been a rabbinic seminary. Had Rabbi Soloveitchik been elected, there would be no college left. It would all be a Litvishi yeshiva. This is what cynics said on the street. Gentlemen, what did we do in today's Shia and Yom HaShoah? Baruch Hashem, we tried to paint the picture of what state American Torah was in 40, 41. What becomes YU faces such a difficult decision, who will be the second president. We described Rabbi Young, we described Moriu Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, but we're just getting involved, we're just touching the surface of a machloket that goes on for three good, devastating years with tremendous heartache, rechilat, lashon hara, sinat chinam, everything that goes with the websites and everything that accompanies machloket. Now, first of all, the great institution known as Yeshiva University is bringing its humble servant, Aaron Rakefa, to America for 2 weeks of festivities over the fourth edition of my first two books, Revel and Silva. I have more positive vibrations that they will get the books here, but I'll know a little more when I get back. With this in mind, I have published up the schedule for the rest of the year, because I don't want to walk in 3 weeks from now and find no one here thinking I'm still in America. There are 5 Sheurim left in the year. Sunday, Monday, May 18th, 19th, Sunday is Lag BaOmer, but their regular classes in Gross. Sunday, Monday, May 25th, May 26th. June 1st, the final day of the year. It is a special lecture, the status of the Torah civilization at this moment in time, a charge to the young rabbis. Please, when the class ends, take a copy of the schedule so you know. Now, watch. What you're about to see is another $99,000 linked to the shekel, to the IOU list. What you see before you is a book made in my honor in Leningrad in the 1980s. And it ties right in to the end of today's lecture. We need Yosef Chaim to translate. As I recall what this is about, I've now been teaching in Leningrad and sending people to teach, and we now have reawakened their interest in Judaism. And from Leningrad, a whole group goes to Volozhin, and here are pictures of what Volozhin looks like, which they discover in the 1980s. Can you explain the title?
Journey into Volozhin.
Journey into Volozhin. Here is an old tombstone. Here, take a look. You can gather around. Here is the old cemetery of Volozhin. Can you translate? Here. Look at the way they put this book together. Can you translate the tombstone? What do they say?
You should have him write a translation to the whole thing.
I have a summarized.
This is a memorial for victims of World War II.
Victims of World War II in Volozhin. Here. This is the pits for Yom HaShoah. Take a look. This you see all over Europe, where tens of thousands of Jews are buried. All you have is a mound left. I have relatives and buried that way outside of Minsk.
Five hills over there, 300 people under each. Yaakov Persky?
Right. Now, Yaakov Persky can be a great-grandfather of our president. Shimon Peres, what's his real name? Persky, that's the original name.
How close is Volozhin to
Vilna?
No, Leningrad.
It's far. Uh-huh. It's very close to Vilna, but it's far from Leningrad. It's White Russia, and then the other one is Russia. What's this? Read it.
Sarleya Bas Shlomo Zalman.
Yeah, Rav Shlomo Zalman, by the way, was the name of the Vilna Gaon's brother, but it doesn't mean here. Look what the cemetery looks like. Oh, God. The legend. I'm sure they fixed it up today. What do we have here?
This was a bathhouse. It's a ruins of bathhouse next to a shul. And not too far from the cemetery.
Look at the streets. Look what Russia looked like in the 1980s. A Potemkin's village. Look at that. Just look. All right. What do we have here?
Azos HaTorah.
Ah. This was the Volozhin Yeshiva. That's the building.
Doesn't it look different in the pictures they have with the gold windows, or that's it?
Well, they opened up the windows, but that's the way it was stuffed up. It was a storehouse, evidently.
They had a dormitory for the boys, or they?
No, they didn't have a dormitory. It was
them
gegessen teg. If they would have had a dormitory, it would have been a different world.
No, they had for sleeping. They had.
No, no, no.
In Slobodka they had
Slobodka
a dorm.
Slobodka was much more advanced. This is for luxury.
Yeah, Chachmei Lublin, that was the first yeshiva.
The first, right. What is that? What is the building saying in?
Culinaria.
Right, Culinaria. This part of the building, this was a, the workers used to eat lunch here. We use the word in English, don't we, culinary?
Yeah.
To give food. The workers used to eat lunch here.
It's carb. Carb.
English would say.
Look at that.
What's that?
That's the front of the building?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
that was the yeshiva? Yeah.
Look at that. Yeah, and it was kept up by the communists. Here's Dyken. Here's the guy who led the tour. He later organizes a university in Leningrad for the study of Judaism, and someone that I sent becomes their main teacher. He goes back every year, twice a year. His name is Avram Alba Weingart. I quoted him in class. He's the Talmud Mufak of the Sri Deyesh. And he's the one who asked the Shaila when I wanted to send him. He asked from Shlomo Zalman Orbach if he's allowed to go. Sakana. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach told him to ask me, what's the worst thing that has happened? So I told him a few of our people were taka beaten up on the street by hooliganim, you know, knocked around not to go further. So Shlomo Zalman told him he has to go. Okay? So that's a little story. That's the leader. I have pictures of him. Here. What does that say?
Volozhin.
Volozhin.
What's the Russian name for Volozhin?
How do you pronounce it? Volozhin.
Volozhin.
Oh, he's pronouncing it. And 1 second. Here, they're leaving. They're leaving. And this is the way they put the book together. Could you imagine how primitive we're talking about it now? 1 second, I just... Okay, 1 second. Let me give out what I have. Yitzchak,
yes.
Here's for you. Tell us, I showed the clay, you missed it yesterday. Another, you used the Rabbi Goldschneider's Haggadah at the Seder. Anyone use it?
I have it, I looked at it.
It's
I didn't
beautiful.
Use it.
Anyway, I get another gift, an art book from all the manuscripts and the Rav's Torah, David Holzer. That's what you wanted. This is for you. Anyone love Rav Yoel Kahn? These are two more of his lectures on Hasidut. The man is fabulous. This is a YU graduate from Toronto.
Oh, good.
And anyone wants on Parshat HaShavua, he puts out a very, very insightful Rabbi Benjamin Hecht.
And he also wrote a book,
right,
explaining Judaism for people who really have no background.
Okay. And gentlemen, this is a hesped for Rabbi Vadya Yosef. You have to know Moroccan Hebrew to appreciate it, but it's fabulous. And the hesped is given the way hespedim were given all over the world. It was given that way in Europe. Mem Givent, and they cried, and the Baal Mesper, and you'll see what he uses as the theme. But I challenge anyone to take it and tell me they understand the Moroccan Hebrew. It took me many years. It's Rav Avadya's Hebrew. If you understand Rav Avadya, you can understand this. It took me many years to reach the point where I can proudly say I understood every syllable and appreciated every tear. Until we meet again in health and happiness, please pray for my well-being. The schedule that happened in America is enough to drive a 40-year-old guy to commit Harry Carey. What do you say when you're practically 2 times 40? But there's Rat Hashem. I got a big compliment this morning from Rabbi Rebel's niece. I said, she called me, heard the book is coming out. It's Rabbi Bespitsky, Leib Bespitsky's widow. So she says, she sounds so young. So I found out the secret, the debt that I owe to Rabbi Manny Holzer. He brought this microphone over for me, in my first microphone. This is why you brought for me. The first one is in my office. It's a relic. In 1970. And I now understand, when you grow older, my wife had a problem. Her speech has become a little quieter. Certain things have to connect in your glucose. As you grow older, they don't connect. So they tell you, you know, it's not much you can do unless you want to do physical therapy and take, but it's not worth the effort. But in my case, what has saved my voice is I've used the microphone since 1970. So my speech is like a kid of the age of 1970. So I felt so happy. She told me, you sound like a kid. I said, I need a kid's energy. It'll be fine, Shalala. But okay, we'll do what we can, B'ezrat Hashem. And you know, and I've already spoke with one person this morning on the Board of Trustees, but you see, the problem is that no one feels a personal debt to Rabbi Belkin. I feel it. If someone would feel it, something would happen. But this way, Rakefet will press, and everyone will say, yes, yes, you're right, you're right, you're right. And 24 hours later, you'll meet the person I spoke with, and you'll say, hey, do you know Rav Rakefet? Who? What? When? Where? Okay. I am a... Charlie, I'm a realist. I don't overstate the case. Believe me, I know what I'm saying. Everyone will say, yes, yes, 24 hours later, forgotten, gone, but Baruch Hashem. I hope we will bring justice to MTA, but I have to tell you, it's very moving to me. Because you know when the last time I spoke in Lamport Auditorium was? 1955, I was valedictorian of the MTA graduation. That's the last time I spoke in MTA. By the way, Sam Dershowitz tells me he remembers you from Brookline. Okay, so we were walking to shul this morning and he was asking me, what are you going to teach today? What's going to be? Who's going to be in class? And Baruch Hashem. He sends regards. Gentlemen, until we meet again in health and happiness, das Chodanya.